Good afternoon and welcome Rotarians and guests. My name is Kevin Sheehan, as President of the Rotary Club of Melbourne. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 33rd meeting of the Rotary year. In fact, our 4,833rd meeting of our club, but the first online meeting in our 99-year history. We are broadcasting from the Rotary office in Collins Street, Melbourne, and hope that technology will be kind and work as planned. Questions to the speaker can be forwarded by email to Joe Maveris in the Rotary office during the presentation. A reminder, if you have difficulties, we will be loading the address as a podcast on the club website in a day or so. Our guest speaker today is distinguished immunologist, scientist and Nobel laureate, Professor Peter Doherty AC, our honorary member. Peter will be speaking on the impact of COVID-19 virus, why flattening the curve matters, and how best we can protect ourselves and the community. It's certainly a pleasure to introduce Peter, who's well known to our audience, but also well known, of course, to the Australian community, having been awarded the Nobel Medicine Prize in 1996, with the Swiss colleague Rolf Zinkernagel for his work on T-cell medicated immunity. He trained as a veterinary science at Queensland University and took most of his seminal research at St Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, USA, and returned to Australia to the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Melbourne University in 2002. The Doherty Institute, a collaboration of Melbourne University and Melbourne Health Royal Melbourne Hospital, where he is now patron, is a fitting tribute to Peter's ongoing contribution to medical science in this country. Professor Doherty delivered the 45th Angus Mitchell Oration in 2015, at which time, in answer to a question, he proffered his opinion that the biggest pandemic threat was likely to come from influenza rather than Ebola. I'm confident his address today on the current pandemic of coronavirus will amplify the reasons why he almost got it right and bring us up to date with the world opinion on what we are facing in 2020 and beyond. It is a great pleasure to now introduce Professor Peter Doherty. Peter.
Thanks very much, Kevin, for the very nice introduction. I think the way we might run this is that I'll sort of talk, and then Kevin's got some questions, and we can pick up on what's not being covered. So just before I forget, I think our leading epidemiologist, Josie McVernon, may be on the National Press Club today. So I think we might be simultaneous. Press Club usually hears at about 1 o'clock, doesn't it? So maybe if you miss that, maybe you could catch up on what Jodie has to say, because she's got a lot of the expertise about spread of infection and that sort of thing. So just to amplify a bit on background, my own personal background, I did train initially as a vet. I've been a researcher all my life and basically worked on infection and immunity. I did that for about 10 years with domestic animals, and then switched to working largely with mice, which made me a medical researcher, an MD, a mouse doctor. And I've been in basic biomedical research since about 1972. So a lot of my career has been in the United States, where I was very much involved with the major funding agency, the National Institutes of Health, and sat on many committees and so forth and task forces to do with human disease. And since coming back to the University of Melbourne, Department of Microbiology and Immunology, we've had a very big influenza program for a number of years, which just finished at the end of last year. And are we okay? Yeah, and Catherine Kidziaska, who has just published a very insightful short paper on the first real serious immunological analysis of this infection, was one of my postdoctoral fellows. She's now a full professor And as a senior scientist, I've been doing what all science senior scientists should do, is get out of the way. And in fact, I thought I was retiring, but in actual fact, it now seems that I'm back in harness, because this is my world and I have to be involved. So for the Institute, for the Peter Doherty Institute, which is named for me, but I don't head it in any sense and I have no administrative responsibility there. For the Institute, I'm helping with the communication side, because everyone is under enormous pressure. And as a consequence, people are getting quite tired, in fact. And that's really one of the concerns, is the concern that the people in the labs, and if this really blows up clinically in a big way, then not only part of the resources that could be exhausted are our personal resources, our human resources, our healthcare professionals. And there's some suggestion, of course, that if doctors and nurses and so forth do become very tired and very stressed, they are more susceptible to the infection. And of course, they're in the front line and we must do everything to protect them. Just a little bit about the Institute. The Institute is a unique institution for Australia. It's the brainchild of Jim McCluskey at the university. Mike Catton, who is running the virus diagnosis currently for COVID-19, and Anne Kelso and several other colleagues who came up with the idea that we should have something equivalent to the American Centers for Disease Control. And so what we've done is unique in Australia. We've brought together the University Department of Microbiology and Immunology, which I think is generally acknowledged to be the best in the country, with the State Virus Diagnostic Laboratory, VIDRL, which is headed by Mike Catton, and with State Bacterial Diagnostics and everything else. So the pressure has all been on VIDRL, Mike Catton's outfit, who've been doing all the testing. And they're funded through Melbourne Health. Our funding comes through the university, through Melbourne Health, and through Royal Melbourne Hospital. And, of course, through research grants and the usual mechanisms in an academic institution. But we are the closest because we combine both practical and the academic side of research on infectious disease. And so we're kind of proud of ourselves, and I think we were the first, through Mike's outfit, Julian Drews there was the first to isolate the nCoV-2, which is the name of the virus. COVID-19 is the name of the disease. We were the first to isolate the virus, and we were the first to hand it out globally, which is kind of important because that allows people to make inactivated virus to check tests and all sorts of things like that. And in general, there's a very strong global cooperation, both at the level of the research and infectious disease control, and at the level of the business community, which is so important in supplying us with the reagents and so forth that we need for the testing. At the moment, you need have no fear we're running out of test kits or anything like that, though it has been mooted through the community. We're testing a lot of people. The latest results for Melbourne, which is basically today, is that of those tested, and these are people who are concerned, they're either the worried well or they're people who have some sort of respiratory symptoms or have been sent in by their doctor. So the testing frequency at the moment is only about less than 1% coming up as positive. So at this stage in Melbourne, we do not think there's a lot of background infection in the community. But that could change very, very quickly. This infection has an R-naught of somewhere above 2.5. Now, an R-naught means simply that if one person is infected, they can potentially infect another 2.5 to 3 people. That's under conditions of reasonable spacing, not necessarily the 1.5 metres that people are recommending. But if you cram people together in large numbers, that number will go up dramatically, which is why everyone's backing away from large gatherings. I see the Prime Minister in his latest address has said no more than 100 people. Obviously, that depends, or the risk depends, on the degree of crowding and the degree of personal contact. And so a lot of these things we have to make sort of general statements, of course, at the policy level. Nothing else is possible, and there's a lot of uncertainties. You should realise, of course, that we've only known about this virus for three months at the most, at the very most, and we've always already made enormous progress. That reflects the status of modern molecular science. We've had a diagnostic test very, very quickly. It's a PCR test, which tests for the presence of viral genome. So we're testing for infection. We still don't have, we have serological tests that test for antibody. I'll talk about that a bit later. But we still don't have a good screening test to test for recovered people or background rates of infection that may have led to recovery without people ever realizing they actually had the infection. We need that test, but it's being developed as rapidly as possible, particularly by David Anderson at the Burnet Institute. So all the Melbourne institutes are involved, and the various hospitals are involved. Testing at the moment has been mainly at our institution, by Vidral, but there is now testing going on at Royal Melbourne Hospital. I believe Monash is up to speed, the Alfred, I think Austin's coming online, Dorovitch Pathology is helping, and of course we have to get it out there into the private and healthcare labs to help when we get a really serious situation developing. At the moment, things are reasonably calm. And a lot of our work has been in training people to do these tests, making sure the tests are validated. That is, are we reading the same thing as people at the Austin or the Alfred? That's all been done through our outfit. And also the private labs are increasingly coming online. You heard today perhaps that 100,000 new test kits have been made available. They will probably largely go into the private sector because they're suited to the way they do the testing. And also, you may have heard that they're worried that test capacity will be overwhelmed. Well, we've been testing individual samples from single people. What we're moving to now to conserve reagents and conserve plastics and enable a much greater volume of testing is to pool 8 samples. So what you do is you pool 8 samples, you test that pooled sample. If that pooled sample goes back positive, then you go back and you retest the others. Now, the test itself only takes a few hours, so the people in the lab can do that very quickly. Any delay on getting the results is partly due to delays in reporting and so forth, but the test itself is really quite quick. And we're also adding a lot of personnel to the test labs from the university, basically young postdocs and graduate students, very smart young people who quickly pick up the technology, very responsible, and can help with the manpower. Okay, so that's basically the background to what's happening in Victoria, at least. Of course, there are parallel activities going on in other cities, but I can't really seriously comment on them. As we're kind of part of the team, so to speak, and our people are advising the Chief Medical Officer and the Minister of Health, Jodie McVernon, the epidemiologist that I mentioned recently, and also our public health people, we're not really part of the commentariat. We're part of the workers. Think of me and my comments, think of me as a plumber, not as a vicar, okay? I'm not telling you how to live. I'm telling you what's being done and what makes the water flow, so to speak. So the disease itself. Now, this is the third virus of its type that we've encountered. The first virus of its type, we do have coronaviruses, and we've known about them for many, many years. Coronaviruses are one of the many, many causes of the common cold. There are about 100 different viruses that cause the common cold, which is why people really quickly, early on, once that was realized, abandon any attempt to make a vaccine. It would just be too complicated. So, and they're relatively mild infections, and we don't know a hell of a lot about them, really. We understand the virology, but we've never done serious immunology on them because there's been no particular reason to. They're not life-threatening. They're not particularly problematic. There are other viruses that have taken our attention. There's not unlimited money for research or unlimited personnel. And actually, though you think of science as being enormous, the numbers of people in an area like this are really relatively small, in fact, across the planet. So COVID-19 is part of a different family. It's part of the beta coronaviruses. One of the common cold viruses is a beta coronavirus. And there have been 3 of them so far have come into the human family. I should say also the difference from influenza. I mean, the disease symptoms we're seeing are at the severe end of influenza. And, of course, all of us are relating it back to the 1918-19 influenza pandemic. The viruses are quite different. They're both RNA viruses. That is, their genetic material is RNA. But influenza is what we call a negative strand RNA, like HIV. It has very poor proofreading. So it keeps throwing off mutants, so we get a lot of constant variation. the coronaviruses are positive strand RNA viruses. They have proofreading capacity, and we don't think they're throwing off mutants at anything like the rate that an influenza would be. So we're not too worried about a major variant coming through very quickly. Of course, we don't know how that'll play out because we've never dealt with anything like this. Now, the first of these viruses we encountered was the SARS virus in 2002. And that blew up in China. It spread through East Asia. The only place it got to outside Asia was Toronto. There were individuals that we call super spreaders who seemed to infect a lot of people, and one super spreader went to Toronto. And what happened was, just at the timing of this outbreak in Wuhan, what happened was it happened right at the time of Chinese New Year, and people went everywhere on trains and planes to be with family, and that spread it very quickly, spread it to Hong Kong, got down into Singapore. Now, the countries who've done best with COVID-19 are actually the countries that had an experience of SARS. Singapore had a very bad time of it. Hong Kong had a bad time of it. But they've been then very well set up to deal with COVID-19. And Singapore particularly and Hong Kong have really handled it very fast and very efficiently because they've had all their public health professionals online. So the SARS virus. The SARS virus, we discovered after some time, it was a bit enigmatic to start with. We discovered that it's probably come out of bats. It's gone from bats into a little animal called the Himalayan civet cat, which was sold in live animal markets in China. Chinese have cultural practices that involve them eating wild animals. And that multiplied up, infected people in the live animal market, and then others were infected and carried around the country. That might have been going on for years, but it just hadn't broken out, so to speak. This often happens in all sorts of epidemiological situations. Something could be around for ages, like a plant sitting in the Darwin Botanic Gardens, and there's no problem, and suddenly it's all over the place. So we don't really quite know that the reasons for that. But that's what happened with SARS. So SARS was more lethal than COVID-19, but much less infectious. And that was closed off fairly quickly. A lot of the deaths were in hospital personnel because the SARS patients were pushing out a lot of virus late, and initially the doctors and nurses didn't understand that, and so a lot of them died. So SARS was really controlled just by good hygiene and by isolation, and it hasn't come back. So the next one of these occurrences was the MERS virus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syncytial Virus, much the same sort of virus. We think it's come from bats into camels in the Middle East and then into humans. So you can see there's a common theme here. These viruses tend to come out of bats into another species, then across to humans. There are other viruses like this that have different families. One is the Hendra virus in Queensland, which goes from bats to horses to humans. Very few cases yet, but an absolutely horrific disease. The other one is the Nipah virus, which goes from bats to pigs and to humans, which has been around in the Southeast Asian region. I think also got up as far as India, maybe even Italy. And it goes from bats to pigs to humans. So the breaking that transmission is important. But none of these really have warranted actually making a vaccine. The incidence is so low. So the MERS virus, it did get across into Asia. It's more infectious than SARS, we think, less severe. But I'm not sure if it's less severe, still pretty severe, actually. So then we've got COVID-19 coming along. And the thought is that this is, and this is not by no means proven, that it's come from bats into a species called the pangolin, which is sold maybe in the live animal markets in Wuhan. The initial focus of infection is what's called the seafood market. But it's not coming from fish. We've never had a major virus pathogen of humans coming across from a cold-blooded species. Unlike bacteria, viruses haven't done that. And so we think it went from the bats, maybe to the pangolin, there's a big question mark there, then across into humans. And it turns out this virus is much more infectious than SARS, at least as infectious as flu, and that it's spread rather rapidly. And, of course, it can cause very severe disease. And those at greatest risk are the elderly and people with other conditions like immunosuppression of some sort due to some either therapy or some genetic disease or something of the sort. So what do we know about the death rate? We're not really very sure because we don't have good information on background infection in the community. There's various figures coming out of various places. where there's been different intensity of testing. It could be that the death rate, we think it's quite possible the death rate overall is about 1% of people who are infected, we think. I mean, there have been estimates much, much higher than that, 2.5% higher than that. But we think it may be around 1% because we think there may be a pretty substantial number of people who don't report clinically but are still spreading. So that means a lot of people are getting infected. They may not even notice they're being infected. They recover quite normally and they're fine and they'll be immune. Now, what we need is an antibody test to test those people to show them that they are in fact immune and they can live quite normally. They don't need to practice any restrictions once you've had it. Been infected and had it, it's pretty unlikely you get infected again. There's no reason to, really serious reason to think we can, and they will be immune. And they could also help a lot because they could be out in the community helping people who are much more vulnerable and they wouldn't be at risk. So we think most young people are probably okay. The incidence in children is very low, as far as we know. And the and though there's been a lot of talk about closing schools, the actual evidence that has spread through schools and school children is not good. We know that it is for flu. We know influenza can be spread very much by school children. They often bring it home. But it's not clear that that's the case for COVID-19. Nonetheless, I think it's really good that particularly the boarding schools have closed and that they've sent their boarders home because we're talking about boarding school. We're talking also about a lot of young adults. And so even if children, smaller children may not get infected much, and we don't know that's true or not really, then we don't want people taking it to rural and remote communities. So shutting them down and sending the borders home is a really good strategy because we don't want to see people infected, particularly in the Indigenous communities. And in fact, all the Indigenous communities are pretty much on the point of closing down outside visitations by anyone, which is... very sound strategy. If we can keep it out of those communities, that'll be great. Our Indigenous people are always more susceptible. They have more comorbidities due to various other conditions. There may also be genetic reasons, we don't know. But it's always a very vulnerable population. And of course, once you get into rural communities, your medical services are not so great. And there's only so many people you can evacuate and all the rest of it. So that's the situation there. What we do know is that younger people, people in their 30s and 40s and even younger, can get very sick and they can die. But that's relatively a lower incidence. We know that some of the young medical professionals in Wuhan got sick and died. They were working enormously hard and they were lost. But we do know that the incidence in older people is much, much higher. And we think from the available figures, those in their 70s are on average 3 to 4 times more likely to contract this disease and have very serious consequences, and 5 to 6 times that of the normal background if you're in your 80s. If you've got comorbidities, and this includes smoking, if you smoke, stop smoking. That's because smoking upregulates what's called the ACE receptor. If you've been treated for cardiovascular disease, some of you may be on ACE inhibitors. Smoking upregulates the ACE receptor, and the ACE receptor is one of the receptors the virus uses to getting into the cell. So stop smoking if you're a smoker. Other comorbidities are high blood pressure. If, like me, you've got high blood pressure and you're being medicated, that's fine, but you're still at risk from the high blood pressure. And then anything that's an immunosuppressive type drug. Anecdotally, and I don't have publication on this, and I'm not a medical doctor, so I'm not giving you medical advice, but I've heard that there could be some risk with using ibuprofen. That's Voltaren, those non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. So I don't know the validity of that, but that might be something to avoid. Now, the infection itself is essentially a respiratory infection, but though we think of most respiratory infection as breathing stuff in, most respiratory infections actually are hand-to-mouth, hand-to-nose. So one of the things to train ourselves not to do is touch our hand and our hands to our face, and that's been widely publicized. And also to keep your hands very clean, you know, scrub under the tap with soap, sing happy birthday twice. And I haven't heard people singing happy birthday in bathrooms, but maybe they're doing it silently. Soap and water are as good as anything. they'll kill the virus just as well. Alcohol's fine, but, you know, you often don't distribute alcohol as well as you would distribute salt, soap and water, and that will kill the virus. Be also aware that the virus can survive quite long times on surfaces. We know that on plastic, it can survive for up to 9 days, maybe more. So if you're buying a lot of goods encased in plastic, either wear gloves when you're opening them out and try and not cross-contaminate, or you could spray it down with some vinegar would probably do it, actually, hypochlorite, all sorts of things, just wash it down and so forth and be careful. So the disease itself, respiratory infection, in the majority of people, and that's more than 80%, it's just going to be an upper respiratory tract infection, as far as we know, that people will have coughs and sneezes, they'll feel a bit bad. What's characteristic is a high fever. If your fever goes up to 37.8, 38 degrees centigrade, that's a good indication you might need to be tested and you might be developing this. And so high fever is what we've been mostly going on. But as I said, there's a lot of background infection that doesn't manifest system in any way. So people who are not showing signs of infection could be transmitting. But it's going to be important for you to get a, if you're sick, it will be important for you to get a diagnosis because that will determine the way you are treated clinically. So if you do get a high fever, and it's important if you to get tested and get a diagnosis. The guidelines on testing are being relaxed. It was that you could only get tested if you've been in contact with someone who's been overseas or in contact with someone who's infected. But that's being relaxed. And what people should do is actually look at their local health site. I think it's the Victorian HHS site in our case, but all the different jurisdictions will have their own site, which will give you advice on testing and all the rest of it. And there is this clinic, fever clinic, at least at Royal Melbourne Hospital in Grattan Street. It's just at one of the ambulance entrances, actually. But don't go along there if you've just got a few sniffles. If you've got a high fever, that's something to consider. But it's always best to call into your doctor anyway and ask them and talk to the medical professionals. So the disease itself, virus gets into the upper respiratory tract infection with some systemic type symptoms. And that's due partly to the response elements that we make. A lot of sickness in virus infections is not so much due to the virus itself, it's due to the way we respond to it and the various chemicals that are made as we respond to the infection. These are called cytokines and chemokines. And their job is to try and limit infections by, say, bacteria and so forth. And so these cytokines and chemokines, though, can make us rather sick because they're quite, in some ways, they're rather toxic and they get into the blood and they circulate and all the rest of it. So the initial infection phase, most people, if they get a respiratory infection, it's going to be transient. They're going to feel better in a few days, 10 days, 12 days. They may be asked to isolate for 10 to 14 days and they'll be fine. And it's very unlikely they would be transmitting after that or that they would be a major risk. If you have a serious first phase and you get quite sick, don't assume, even though you may become virus negative and people say you're okay, just be very careful and take it easy for another couple of weeks because people can relapse. And, of course, if you've got any symptoms at all of respiratory infection, don't think I can exercise my way out of this because what you will do is drag the virus right down to the bottom of your lung, which is the last place you want it to be. You want it to stay up top, up high. Keep fit and exercise until you get some symptoms. But if you do get some symptoms, just take it a bit quietly. What can happen in the relapse situation or in very, you know, I'm touching my hand for my face. I wiped myself down with hand sanitizer, so I should be all right. We all do tend to touch our hands to our face. But maybe if you're in a bathroom where there's twist taps and there's no paper towels to turn them off, be like the Arabs, use your left hand for all the things that you don't want to contaminate with and use your right hand for scratching your nose, right? Yeah, I've got a studio audience here. They're very quiet. Very subdued. I'm not too young. On the whole. And so sort of in general, what can happen in a very severe acute infection or in if a relapse, we're not sure. And, you know, we've known about this so short a time that we haven't done a lot of work yet. We haven't been able to because everyone's obsessed with tests and testing. But we think that it may be a cytokine storm type effect. That is, the host response is too effulgent. And if you think about the lung, it's an incredibly delicate organ because we've got the terminal bronchi where the gas exchange goes from the red blood cells. And once you clog that up, we're very, very susceptible. So with the latest 2009 influenza pandemic, for instance, where a reasonable number of really fit young people were in intensive care, some of them were put on ECMO, that is, they were put on heart-lung machines, and about 50% of them were saved because they got them through that crisis. Of course, the problem is if we get large numbers of cases, all our those sort of facilities will rapidly be overwhelmed, and as will the medical services. What we're trying to avoid is that happening. But if the late onset disease, it can give you this effulgent inflammatory disease. Of course, you'll be under medical care then. And also the other thing that can happen is acute cardiac death. It seems there's an acute cardiac failure that could be electrical, could be related to the fact that the heart has a lot of ACE inhibitors on. We really don't know, but there is a report of this. But at this stage, you're well and truly under medical care, so there's no point in my saying anything. There are some strategies out there that are being tested currently. There's a number of things that are being tested. There's an antiviral drug called remdesivir, I think it is, which is an anti-Ebola drug, works through the protease, virus protease. It looks as though it may have some promise against this virus and, in fact, work better against this than it did against Ebola. And so that's been tested in China. We haven't seen the trial results yet, as far as I know. There's another protease inhibitor from HIV called Keytruda, which is also being tested and may have some effect. And you can bet your life there are a lot of people developing specific antiviral drugs, but they will take a while to get tested and get available for treatment. And they probably only would work relatively early in the disease, I would think. The other thing that's been tested is to try and dampen down that effulgent host response, the inflammatory cytokine type response. It could be that the malaria drug hydroxychloroquine has some effect here. It's being found to be generally beneficial in a lot of these severe respiratory diseases, and it could be beneficial here too. So hydroxychloroquine is part of the armamentarium. So if you've got any old anti-malarial medicine in the cabinet that you haven't used, check out and see what it is. We don't want people rushing to the pharmacy to buy up all the hydroxychloroquine because we need it available for the medical people. Maybe avoid non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Did I mention that? Okay. That's about it, really. And just be sensible. Isolation. We're sort of asking older people, and I'm in the category, my wife's in the category, to self-isolate as much as possible. So I'm avoiding, I'm down in downtown today, but I won't be downtown much after this. I'm doing everything. I'm doing a lot of public communication stuff. I'm doing it all via the cell phone. I've recently learned how to Skype. I haven't been a Skyper. I've left it all to my secretary. Now I have to do it. And so I'm Skyping and Zooming and all this sort of stuff. I think the digital world is coming into its own. And, of course, that's one great advantage we have over 1919. I should say that in 1918, with the influenza pandemic, the first influenza virus wasn't isolated until 1933. So you can see we're way ahead of the curve. So that's about where we are with the actual disease. Let's see. The vaccine, okay? What's been happening across the planet, we're infinitely ahead of where we were in 2002 when SARS hit. We're just incredibly better at the science, and we've got fantastic technology. And not so coming so much out of the basic research labs like ours, but coming out of industry research and some of the technology is fantastic. And so the fact that we had diagnostic tests online very fast, and we're going straight into a vaccine. One vaccine candidate is already in test in Seattle, and the Moderna vaccine, funded through the National Institute of Health initially, that's the equivalent of our National Health and Medical Research Council. And we also have what's called a protein clamp vaccine, which has been developed over some years at the University of Queensland by Paul Young and his group. This is a strategy whereby they kind of clamp the protein. Now, to be a bit technical, the virus has proteins on its surface. These are the targets of the antibodies, which are the protective entity in, say, an influenza vaccine or a measles vaccine or anything else. But those proteins on the cell surface, which may be attachment proteins that get into the cell, they're what's important is what's called their conformation. That is the way the protein is folded to make that structure, because that's what a lot of the antibody is against, what we call conformational determinants. That is the folded protein. And so this clamp vaccine has the advantage that it keeps the protein in its right conformation. And the fact that we pull it out, the protein out, before we use it and purify it and try to make it into a vaccine, it's pulled out with antibody. So by definition, it binds antibody in the first place. So that's an innovative vaccine. It's had about 2 years funding from an international agency that was set up exactly for this reason, to develop what we call platform technologies that can be used for making a novel vaccine. So this is a flat platform. It's been developed so you can slot any protein from any pathogen into it. And now it's been tested with COVID-19, or MCOV2 as the virus is called. So that vaccine, University of Queensland in origin, it's being a lot of the virus has been grown up by the CSIRO. They have facilities to do this. Relatively new facility, I believe. It has to be made under what we call GMP conditions, good manufacturing practice, before it can go into humans. And also we are involved with helping to test, as they do animal tests and so forth. What will happen with the testing, if it looks promising from animal tests, which I think are important, but I think we'd also be going into humans very early with what we call a phase 1 or safety trial. What we would be looking for there is to see whether it makes neutralizing antibody. Firstly, that it's safe. Secondly, it makes antibody that neutralizes the virus, which is a test we can do in tissue culture. So if it makes neutralizing antibody, it will look to be a promising vaccine candidate. Then it will have to go through a much bigger phase 2 trial, which is both safety and efficacy, and then a phase 3 trial. Now, we're currently discussing what sort of form that might take, and trying to understand better how to do that, because it's not like testing a normal drug. It's testing something in the face of a pandemic, and there may be emergency type legislation that allows us to get things out there very quickly if we're satisfied that it is safe and it is efficacious. But we'll see. We just have to see how that plays out. There's a lot of unknowns in this whole thing. But so the vaccine at the moment, we're saying, is 12 to 18 months off. Possibly it could be quicker. It would be wonderful if it was. I'd certainly be putting my hand up to be a test case. I mean, it's all a risk-benefit analysis, and I'm in the high-risk category. So I'm self-isolating. So grandparents and grandchildren, at the moment, the advice is to try and keep grandparents away from grandchildren. That's very difficult, because a lot of grandparents, of course, are rather emotionally dependent on contact with grandchildren. So, but it's best if we can to keep grandparents and older people and vulnerable people isolated. With respect to people who have immunodeficiencies, and this is some of the physically challenged people and people who've been had various therapies, and older people too, who just don't make a good immune response and are on human immunoglobulin treatment to give them some antibodies. Of course, the COVID-19 antibodies are not in that mix. So what's being done there is, I think, CSL, which is the world's biggest blood product company and is an Australian company and does this all the time, I think CSL will be testing or is testing recovered individuals, taking their blood and serum and seeing whether that could be reinfused into other people as part of the immunoglobulin to try and protect them. We're also developing what's called monoclonal antibodies. A number of labs are doing this, including the Hall Institute, our place. We're also developing an alternative vaccine based on a different technology in case this one falls down. But there are large numbers of vaccine in test, different types of vaccine in test around the planet. Monoclonal antibodies, which a pure clone of antibody. These are the mAb drugs that you see used in anti-cancer therapy and are being used in anti-rheumatoid and all that sort of stuff. Those drugs are monoclonals, but these would be against the virus, not against some host protein. So they might be actually added into the immunoglobulin to try and protect people who have defective immune systems and just can't make immune responses. If we do get a vaccine, of course, the question will be how well it will work in the elderly, because vaccines don't work as well for new things in us when we're older. We lose a lot of what we call our capacity to make a naive response. The so-called flattening of the response. What people are interested in here is this debate going on: if the virus does start to spread very much in the community and very rapidly, and it's highly likely that will happen from what's happened elsewhere. The question is, the Brits, I mean, I'm not sure that this is their policy, but the Dutch say now it is theirs, is the question is just let it rip. Infect as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. Then you'll have lots of immune people. 80 to 90% will be fine. And then you'll have what's called herd immunity. Those people won't be reinfected. And because they're not getting reinfected, the numbers of people who can be infected will be much lower, so there'll be much less spread, and we'll be through this. And at the same time, try and lock up Granny and Granddad and throw away the key and feed them through a slot or something until that happens, and give them some toilet paper, of course, because we can make toilet paper in Australia. We're not totally deficient. And so so that question is, the other approach is to do what I think we're aiming to do here with a graded response. You'll see the Prime Minister's been quite effective on this. I think the Health Minister's doing a good job. They're taking the advice of the Chief Medical Officer, who in turn is taking the advice of all sorts of specialists in public health and epidemiology, and I think they're broadly saying they're doing the right thing. The Grand Prix was a bit of a glitch, but nobody gets everything right, do they? So now I've lost my point, I think. Basically follow what's being recommended from government and so forth, and follow those recommendations closely. So, but the approach that's likely to happen here, we're seeing already a graded response. At the weekend it was meetings of 500, now it's meetings of 100. That may go down. We may see cafes closed and all sorts of things happen. That could happen. And the aim with that will be to decrease the transmission so that we can prolong the course of the outbreak. And the reason for that is so we don't get enormous numbers of cases simultaneously and overwhelm the hospitals. But that will take longer and it will cause more economic damage. And that's just a fact of life. And so getting it over quickly would help, but we'd lose more people. You may have seen video, for instance, of a poor 60-year-old woman being turned away with severe respiratory symptoms because they basically triaged her. And so basically the problem is not only hospital beds, it's the availability of ventilators, it's the availability of other intensive care type technology. We're currently in Victoria, I think, having a large push to get a lot of elective surgery through, get that over, because what will happen then is that not only the intensive care units, but the areas that are used for recovery from surgery and those areas which are set up for this sort of thing will be used as intensive care units. Now, of course, we may have to go beyond that. You will have seen images from China during the Wuhan epidemic, beds lined up one next to the other in what looked like tents, but with ventilators attached to the patients. And it could be that we will get, say, more ventilators from China and so forth. China has been, after an initial glitch phase, they've really been pretty good about this, and they've been pretty open, we think, and really telling everyone what's happening and doing their best. And they've been remarkably effective, as they can be in ways that maybe we can't. But they have been sending medical teams to Italy, and I think they've sent extra ventilators and all the rest of it. Italy is having a terrible time. So that's about what I can say about it generally. I don't know what other questions we can add to that.
Peter, you've covered so many of the questions that we've had emailed in. Yeah. It's been magnificent. But there's a couple of here you might deal with. And one from Joe Mavros was, what does self-isolation really look like? How do you do that in your home?
Well, we're trying to work this out at the moment. I mean, you know, my wife and I are both in the age group that's very susceptible. We've both got other conditions, as most of us have at this age. I mean, what do we do? Well, firstly, we're not going to movie theatres, or we'll stop going to restaurants and so forth. And and just isolate at home and stay away from the grandkids. And after, you know, maybe this week, next week might be okay. But once, if case numbers start to ramp up, then you start to take real precautions. And you can read, we've been quite open about the numbers of people who are diagnosed. You can read in the newspaper, read online and all the rest of it, how problematic a newspaper is. So it's basically staying at home. Then the question is, how much do you isolate within the home? Well, you know, might be a good idea if you've got a couple of bathrooms to separate the use of bathrooms. And a likely source of contamination is, you know, cleaning your teeth, that sort of thing. So that's the sort of thing that I think people just need to think through themselves and just be sensible about it. Avoid using the same crockery and that sort of thing. So I think it's just a matter of being sensible and practical and thinking that, you know, there may be a germ on this surface. What do I do about that? And just being sensible. But we're going to live a fairly quiet life. We've got a house down at Wendelands, so we'll be down there a bit. I think walking along the beach is going to be fine. I never see that many people on the beach, especially in winter. And so, you know, going out for a walk where you're not seeing large numbers of people. And if you do see them, stay 1.5 metres away and don't shake hands. Do the Indian greeting and hope they don't punch you out or something. But so it's just a lot of this is common sense. And, you know, reasonably switched on, people are going to take that. The people are extraordinarily vulnerable, of course, some of the disabled and so forth. But at the moment, you may be well aware that, for instance, if you've got a relative in a nursing home, you've been told you can't visit for a month, and that's likely to be extended. So, and that's to protect them, and it's very sound, and it's good to see them stepping up. So far in Australia, after that initial outbreak in the nursing home, we haven't seen a lot of deaths in older people, and most of the cases have been in younger people, which kind of implies that the nursing homes are doing a reasonably good job of practicing what should be done. And that may well be for retirement communities in general, we hope.
Thank you, Peter. And other questions came in from Rob Helm and Peter Clark. And certainly Peter Clark was asking about whom the herd immunity. You've spoken about that.
Yes.
There's been a lot of it in the newspaper.
Yes, a lot of it. As we know, we live in a world where you don't hear that much from people who actually know something, but you hear a lot from the commentariat. And of course, we all know the dynamics that operate in that space, and some people suddenly find an opportunity to be much more prominent than they otherwise might have been. And so listen to that with the kind of scepticism that you would apply to most such situations.
Thank you. Well, Peter, it's been fabulous of you to firstly come in today and secondly give us the benefit of your knowledge and your experience. I mean, everyone is asking the question, when will we get back to normal? We won't ask you to necessarily crystal ball that, but I guess that is probably a good way to finalise our discussion.
That's a good point. I mean, what is normal going to look like after this? The normal may be different. I mean, this may be a transforming event. Just as some people think the bushfires have been a transforming event. Now, with respect to the government, I think our government is doing the right thing. I think it's playing to the strengths of the Liberal Party. I don't think climate change necessarily does, and I've been highly critical of them there. But I think in this, they're doing exactly the right thing. They're following the right lines and listening to expertise. And so I would listen to what they're saying and take notice. So, but the new normal may be rather different. I mean, the new normal may be quite a big shakeout in small business, unfortunately. And of course, we may all become much more accustomed to online communication than we have been in the past. And so we'll see how it plays out.
Well, on that score, thank you for being part of history for Rotary Melbourne, our first online regular meeting. And perhaps given the current circumstances, there'll be a few more. And also to assist you in walking on the beach at Lonsdale, we have some R100 socks. We have the sports socks manufactured, of course, by Phil and Jane Industry in Preston. Okay. So they're local. And, of course, for when you're more formally dressed, the black socks. And they carry our R100 centenary
logo on them, and we look forward, of course, to next year, and hopefully by 2021 there won't be any more COVID-19 to deal with.
Well, I shall make a practice of flashing my socks up.
Again, thank you, Peter, and thank you to all of our members and who have joined us today. And as I mentioned before, this address will be included on the website as a podcast, so you can listen to it in more detail again. Certainly, it's a wonderful opportunity to hear from our honorary member and our esteemed member, Professor Peter Doherty.